A Poet's Misadventures in Love, set to some of French opera's most luscious music. That's Jacques Offenbach's Les Contes d'Hoffmann, The Tales of Hoffmann, an opera bursting with fantastic imagination. Offenbach and his librettist did actually label it an opéra fantastique, and that describes it perfectly. Hello, I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera of Chicago, and it's my pleasure to speak to you about Les Contes d'Hoffmann. Most of the excerpts I'll be playing come from an EMI Classics recording with Nicolas Yeda as Hoffmann, Gianna D'Angelo as Olympia, Victoria de Los Angeles as Antonia, Elisabeth Schwarzkopf as Julieta, Nicola Gusilev as Lindorf, George London as Coppelius and Dr. Miracle, Ernest Blanc as Dapertutto, Jacques Loraux as the Four Servants, Jeanine Collard as Niklaus, and René Faure as the Muse, with the Chœur René Duclos and the Orchestre de la Société des Concerts du Conservatoire in Paris, conducted by André Cluytens. Although the French eventually took Offenbach to their hearts as their own, he was originally German, born in Cologne in 1819. His father, a cantor and violinist, brought him to Paris in his mid-teens. He was a cellist, and his father wanted him trained at the Conservatoire. They didn't normally take foreign students there, but the director, Luigi Cherubini, made an exception, since the young Offenbach's playing was so outstanding. He didn't stay long at the Conservatoire. Instead, he began playing in the Opéra Comique Orchestra, supplementing his income by performing as a soloist in the salons of fashionable homes. But he was eager to get ahead as a composer. He'd already had his first operetta produced by the time he became a conductor at the Théâtre Français in 1850. He composed for other theaters, but his satirical style wasn't always welcomed. He finally decided to start his own company, renting a little theater originally called the Salle Lacaze. He renamed it literally Parisian Farces, Bouffe Parisien. And there he achieved one triumph after another. Offenbach would produce nearly 100 operettas over the next quarter century, making him the toast of Paris, the man Rossini referred to as the Mozart of the Champs-Élysées. Among the most captivating of the full-length pieces were Orfeo aux Enfers, La Belle Hélène, La Vie Parisienne, La Grande Duchesse de Gerolstein, and La Pericole. There were also one-act farces and musical revues. Everything showed a glorious gift for melody and a biting wit that none of Offenbach's peers could match. By the late 1870s, the vogue for operetta wasn't quite what it had been. Tastes were starting to change in Paris. Also, due to serious gout, Offenbach's health was starting to deteriorate. His previous triumphs weren't enough for him. He longed to write the operatic masterpiece he felt would give his name an enduring importance in the musical world. As early as 1851, he'd seen a play, Les Contes Fantastiques d'Hoffmann, The Fantastic Tales of Hoffmann, by two notable writers, Jules Barbier and Michel Carré, who'd also collaborated on opera libretti. Years later, when Offenbach was considering dramatic sources for a full-length, serious opera, he realized that the Barbier-Carré play would be ideal for him. The Opéra Comique agreed to produce the new piece, Barbier prepared a libretto, and Offenbach began work, although with constant interruptions. He was having financial problems, and when circumstances required it, he was able to make the money he needed by dashing off a new operetta in record time. Well, time was running out for him, and he knew it. He managed to finish a Hoffmann piano score. He orchestrated the prologue and the first act, but that was all. After he died in October of 1880, the orchestration was completed by Ernest Guiraud, the composer who became famous for writing recitatives for Carmen after the death of Bizet. Before the piece was produced, Hoffmann's spoken dialogue was changed to recitatives. The head of the Opéra Comique wanted it that way. This made the opera enormously long, so at the premiere, the whole Giulietta act was cut. Hoffmann finally premiered on February 10, 1881. It was a great success, running for 100 performances. From the start, producers have been altering Hoffmann. The most frequently performed version is the one published by Choudens in 1907. It includes the major changes that were created for a Monte Carlo production in 1904. With one exception, the synopsis and music I'll give you in this commentary relates directly to the Choudens edition. The poet of the opera's title is very loosely based on a real-life figure, E.T.A. Hoffmann, who lived from 1776 to 1822. He was a real Renaissance man, a writer, composer, music critic, jurist, draftsman, and caricaturist. But he's best remembered as the creator of fabulous stories. Their wild imagination pointed the way to many great fiction writers of the German Romantic era. The opera's prologue finds us in Luther's tavern in Nuremberg. It's evening, and the stage is lit by moonlight. Suddenly, offstage voices are heard, the spirits of wine and beer, singing glu, 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 we're the friends of men, and we drive away dull cares. This is a quiet, rather gentle way to begin the opera, highly atmospheric and somewhat mysterious. Counselor Lindorf appears. He's the first of the opera's four villains. Whenever any of the four makes an entrance, we hear this sinister, rather creepy theme in the low strings. Lindorf has with him Andres, the servant of Stella. She's the diva who's performing that night in Don Giovanni. It seems she's recently arrived from Milan with a bunch of lovers in pursuit. When Lindorf questions Andres about Stella's doings, he responds with little more than oui and non. Andres has a note for one particular lover. Lindorf bribes him in exchange for the note. Once Lindorf is alone, he reads it. There's a key enclosed. A key that will let Stella's lover into her dressing room. Lindorf sings his two-verse solo. Most of this opera's arias are in two verses, as arias frequently were in Offenbach's operettas. Lindorf explains how uncomfortable he feels playing a languishing lover, but there's a devil lurking in him that lets him triumph through fear. He knows Stella doesn't love him, but still he anticipates that he's the one who will be entering that dressing room. He concludes, je suis vieux, mais je suis vif, which is basically, I'm old, but I've still got some life in me. At the premiere of Hoffmann, the baritone Émile Alexandre Tasquin created Lindorf, as well as the villains of the Olympia act and the Antonia act. No doubt he would have created the villain of the Giulietta act as well if that portion of the opera hadn't been cut. Clearly, Offenbach wanted one singer to play all the villains, which is usually the case in Hoffmann productions today. Lindorf needs quite a light touch for this aria, but at the same time, he's got to dig into the words. You need real bite in the voice, but elegance, too. And that goes for the music for the other three villains. Je sais que je suis pitoyable, mais j'ai de l'esprit comme un diable, comme un diable. Mes yeux lancent des éclairs, j'ai dans tout le physique, j'ai dans tout le physique, un aspect satanique qui bondit sur le nerf et fait d'une pire. Par le mer, j'arrive au cœur, j'attrape. Burgdorf knows exactly who his rival for Stella is. It's Hoffmann, the poet. And he knows that Hoffmann will soon be at the tavern with his friends, whom Lindorf considers young lunatics. The waiters are ready, the doors open, and in comes a group of boisterous young students calling for Luther, the tavern keeper, to bring beer and wine. There's a very lively drinking song. The refrain says, "Keep filling the pewter tankards until morning." It's one of this opera's most exhilarating numbers, perfect for communicating the youth and vigor of this gang of students. The students have come from the Don Giovanni performance. They heard Act One, in which Stella was apparently singing gloriously. One student, Nathanael, drinks a toast to her. Hoffmann now arrives, looking rather grim, and asking for a stool, a glass, and a pipe. Behind him is his friend Niklaus, who also intends to drink and smoke. Hoffmann's suspicious of Lindorf, who's there quietly observing him. He unnerves Hoffmann. And clearly the poet is feeling morose anyway, but his mood changes when one of the students suggests that he tell the story of Kleinsach. "Right, Kleinsach it is," declares Hoffmann, and he's off and running. At the court of Eisenach, Hoffmann tells his friends, there was a little runt of a person named Kleinsach. His legs went click-clack when he walked, he had a hump in place of a stomach, and his feet seemed to emerge as if from out of a sack. In this bit of the aria, you see that vocal beauty isn't really the point. The point is to be an effective storyteller and for the voice really to crackle with energy. Just as Hoffmann's about to start the third verse of the song, where he's going to describe Kleinsach's face, suddenly he thinks of a different face. The face of the young woman that he raced after one day, running through valleys and woods. He remembers her voice, her eyes, everything about her. And as he sings, the music changes radically into something overtly and overwhelmingly romantic. Comme le jour où courant après elle, je quittais comme un fou la maison paternelle et m'enfuis à travers les vallons et les bois. Ses cheveux en dorsale sombre, sur son corps il est gauche de la chaude sombre, ses yeux enveloppés d'azur. Promenait autour d'elle un regard frais et pur, et comme notre char emporte sans secousse nos cœurs et nos amours, sa voix vibrante et douce. Aux yeux qui l'écoutaient, je passe chaque... Finally, Hoffmann pulls himself out of this reverie, and he goes back to describing the misshapen Kleinsach and the way his coattails went flick-flack. Now Hoffmann stirs everyone up by shouting, "Let's get drunk!" He confronts Lindorf, whom he and his friends kid mercilessly. He calls Lindorf the devil. The two of them exchange sarcastic insults, but elegantly. The music is light here. The jaunty middle section of this excerpt is absolutely typical of Offenbach, the operetta composer.
C'est aussi la chose vraie que vous en buvez, cher pot.
Si je la bois, je la peux, cher orateur de tripot.
Avec l'argent comme moi-même, vous me folie, cher vautour.
En admettant que mon rêve soit volable, cher amour.
Ah, madame, profane, cher suppôt de Lucifer.
Que l'amour sur vos mâmes, cher échappe de l'âme,
cher suppôt de Lucifer.
Hoffmann continues to be distressed, being in the presence of Lindorf, who he thinks brings him bad luck. Whether he gambles, whether he falls in love. But that's nothing, interrupts Nathanael. All of us are unlucky in love. Again, Hoffmann's sarcastic, mocking the women his friends are in love with. Is your mistress such a treasure? Asks Hermann, another student. Hoffmann remarks to himself that Stella is actually three women in one. But then aloud he says that he's actually had three mistresses, and now he's offering to tell everyone their stories. Luther announces that Act Two of Don Giovanni is about to start, but no one cares. They settle down to listen as Hoffmann begins, "The name of the first one was Olympia." So ends the prologue. And we're now transported, for Act One, to the fancy Paris home of a well-to-do scientist, Spallanzani. He's reflecting on the fact that, through his daughter, Olympia, he'll be able to recover the 500 ducats he lost when the moneylender he was doing business with went bankrupt. There's still the problem of the inventor, Coppelius. Spallanzani is worried that he may try to claim paternity of Olympia. Hoffmann appears. It seems that he's now a pupil of Spallanzani. Physics is everything, says Spallanzani mysteriously. Olympia is worth a great deal. That leaves Hoffmann totally confused. Spallanzani leaves to see to the champagne for party guests who will soon be arriving. There's a curtain off to one side. Hoffmann raises the curtain and sees Olympia there sleeping. He's enraptured and starts waxing poetic. Let my passion flood you with light. This is an exquisite aria beginning à vivre deux. Ah, to live together, to have the same hopes, the same memories. This is one of the loveliest passages Offenbach ever created for a tenor. You really have to float the voice to keep it buoyant and to bring maximum sweetness to every phrase until the final ascent, where you can let the sound out and give it a fine ring. How unfortunate that the first Hoffmann, Jean-Alexandre Talazac, didn't live long enough for us to hear his voice on records. He was only 39 when he died in 1892. He must have been an amazing singer. In less than a decade, he created the leading tenor roles in Les Contes d'Hoffmann, Lacmé, Manon, Le Roi Dix, and Samson et Dalila. When Niklaus arrives, Hoffmann immediately starts talking about how wonderful Olympia is, but Niklaus is totally skeptical. He sings a little two-verse number about a doll who sang in unison with a little brass cockerel to whom she sighed, "I love you." For the mezzo-soprano singing this trouser role, it's a challenge in this aria to keep an extraordinarily light touch in the singing, also 100% accuracy even in the shortest notes, while maintaining maximum charm. We'll move to a different EMI recording of Hoffmann for this aria. Anne Murray sings with the orchestra of the Théâtre Royal de la Monnaie, Sylvain Cambrelin conducting. Now the nasty, seedy Coppelius appears. He's dragging a sack full of various kinds of eyeglasses. He introduces himself to Hoffmann and Niklaus, and to us, with the aria J'ai des yeux. I have eyes, living eyes, eyes of flame that see into the depths of the soul. He tells Hoffmann that if he wants to see into a woman's heart, he should purchase a pair of these glasses. This is a tricky number. You need real power, but also the ability to color the voice while articulating the words with terrific precision, much of the time at a quick speed, which makes it twice as challenging. This aria wasn't part of the world premiere of Les Contes d'Hoffmann. When the opera was done in Monte Carlo in 1904, opera director Raoul Gainsbourg wanted major changes. He worked with composer André Bloch and writer Pierre Barbier, son of Hoffmann's original librettist. They gave Coppelius new text and took the music for J'ai des yeux from an aria that had belonged to another villain in this opera, Dapertutto. We'll meet him later on. So Hoffmann buys some glasses from Coppelius. When Spallanzani reappears, he and Coppelius have a rather tense conversation. It seems that Olympia's eyes came from Coppelius. Spallanzani can have full paternity of Olympia if he pays Coppelius 500 ducats. He gives him an IOU and tells him he can get the money from the moneylender Elias. So once Coppelius hears that, he and Spallanzani are great pals again. Well, the grandly attired party guests now arrive. They've all heard that Spallanzani's daughter Olympia is ravishing, and they can't wait to meet her. When she's brought in, everyone admires her eyes, her figure, her outfit. But it's clear to us that this girl is actually a mechanical doll. Hoffman's looking at her through the glasses he just bought, and he's totally enchanted. Spallanzani expresses his daughter's delight on her behalf and announces that she'll sing an aria accompanying herself. He asks everyone, should she play the harpsichord, guitar, or harp? His servant, Cochinilla, cries, the harp! And a mysterious deep voice answers from offstage, the harp. Cochinilla fetches the harp, and Olympia begins. Singing her aria, of course the soprano needs pinpoint accuracy and incredible cleanness in her sound, but she can't sound like a machine. She still has to be musical. You'll hear Olympia's energy run out, and then the cranking sound as Cochinilla winds her back up. Adele Isaac, who created Olympia, Antonia, and Stella in this opera, was just the right choice. Not only was she a big favorite at the Opéra Comique, she was also a singer who was equally comfortable in coloratura and lyric roles. She had a lot of brilliance in her voice and was adorable on stage. Niklaus asks why Olympia isn't joining everyone for supper, but Spallanzani manages to avoid the question. Everyone moves to the dining room, but Hoffman stays behind and woos Olympia, who's sitting in an armchair. Only when Hoffman touches her shoulder does she respond, and all she says is, oui, oui. When he touches her a little more aggressively, she rushes out of the room. As he starts to follow her, he's confronted by Niklaus, who says the guests are talking about Olympia. They're saying she's dead, or more accurately, that she was never alive. Hoffman's oblivious. She loves me, he cries, and rushes after her. Coppelius now stalks in. The IOU was worthless, because Elias is now bankrupt. Coppelius wants revenge. Well, Olympia comes back in with Hoffman, and she dances with him to the guests' delight. But the dancing turns frantic, and Hoffman is finally exhausted. Spallanzani says to Olympia, that's enough, child. But Olympia just responds with repetitions of the single syllable, ah. Here again, the coloratura is difficult, especially in the final lines, where Olympia really pulls out all the stops, vocally speaking. Passi, passi, passi.
Oh,
Oceania leads Olympia to her room, but Coppelius is there. We hear the loud sounds of something being broken. Koshini rushes in, saying the eyeglasses man is in there. Spallanzani is beside himself. Coppelius now comes in, holding in his hand pieces of Olympia. Hoffmann now realizes that he loved a mechanical doll. The guests mock him, and Spallanzani is cursing Coppelius as the curtain falls on Act One. From a doll, we move to a lovely, emotionally vulnerable young woman, Antonia. The instrumental introduction to Act Two, we can already hear that things aren't going to end too well for her. When we first see her, she's at home in Munich, sitting at her harpsichord, accompanying herself in a lovely two-verse song, Elle a fui la tourterelle. She's flown, the turtle dove. The verses are very gentle, but each one ascends to a forte high A that cuts off abruptly, as if the ill Antonia had run out of strength. The verses are also absolutely identical musically, which challenges the singer to give variety through the shaping of the text. Antonia's father, Crespel, begs her not to sing. In her, he sees and hears the image of her dead mother, who'd been a singer herself. Crespel worries about Hoffmann's interest in his daughter. He's so worried that, to escape Hoffmann, he's moved his household to Munich. Antonia promises her father she won't sing anymore. Before going out, Crespel cautions his servant, Franz, not to let anyone into the house. Once he's alone, Franz laments that he himself would be a grand singer, too. Also a dancer, were it not for technique, la méthode, which gets in his way. The slight number is all about delicacy and about projecting the words meaningfully without exaggerating the character's sweet silliness. Franz ignores Crespel's orders and admits Hoffmann and Niklaus. Of course, Hoffmann is there to see Antonia, and Franz goes off to fetch her. Hoffmann's perplexed that Crispell was so desperate to keep him away from Antonia. Niklaus wonders if Antonia is really a better choice for Hoffmann's love than Olympia had been. Hoffmann's embarrassed, thinking of his foolish love for Olympia. "Antonia is alive," he proclaims. "She has a soul. She's an angel." Niklaus answers him quietly, "She's an artist. That's why her soul is as strong as that of the instrument here." There's a violin in the room, and Niklaus fingers the strings as he sings a magnificent romance often called the violin aria. It's so stirring emotionally and musically that a good mezzo-soprano invariably steals the show with it. It's actually not part of the Schudin's edition. It was restored when Fritz Oeser's edition of the opera was published in the late 1970s. In the aria, Niklaus describes how the sound box vibrates under the violin's bow to produce a glorious sound. The music can soothe Hoffmann's tears and anguish. Love can conquer him, but what Niklaus means is the love of art. This is what Hoffmann should be living for. The aria covers two full octaves. It's challenging not just in range, but also in the expressive fervor that's required. This excerpt begins in the low-lying middle section and plays to the end of the aria, sung by Anne Murray. When Antonia appears, Niklaus quickly realizes that he's in the way, and he leaves. Hoffmann declares that the next day he and Antonia will be married. They look forward to their future happiness. You can sense their excitement instantly in this music. Hoffmann admits that he feels jealous of music itself. Antonia loves it too much. She's worried that he'll be like her father and forbid her to sing. She sits him down beside her at the harpsichord and sings the love song that they'd sung together before. Here the music becomes much calmer and sweeter. A little moment of repose for the two of them.
Triste fora, se di nascia sola.
Hoffmann hides when Crespel appears. He's distressed when Franz announces the arrival of Miracle, the doctor whose incompetence Crespel believes killed his wife. Now he's worried that Miracle will kill his daughter. Franz goes to send Miracle away, but the doctor, as if by magic, suddenly appears. He's wondering if Antonia is still suffering from the illness she inherited from her mother. The weirdly sinister Miracle begins questioning Crespel as he and Hoffmann become increasingly terrified. Their trio needs a good deal of vocal amplitude from each singer, tremendous intensity, and for Hoffmann, terrific security in the upper register. Miracle proceeds to give Crespel some special flasks containing liquids Antonia must drink every morning. Crespel rejects them and sends Miracle away, declaring, "May the sea swallow you up." Once Crespel is out of the room, Hoffmann is able to see Antonia again. She assumes Hoffmann asked her father for her hand, and he's evasive when she inquires, "What did my father say?" Hoffmann responds that he'll tell her everything later. They agree that they'll be married the next day, and he leaves, having gotten her promise that she won't sing anymore. She repeats that phrase, "I've promised not to sing anymore." And suddenly Miracle is there again. He questions her decision. "How can you make that promise when you're still in the bloom of youth? You'll abandon the excitement of theatrical life, the applause, the glory. You're only 20, and you'll exchange all that for domestic life, caring for little bratty children?" Antonia wonders who can save her. She loves Hoffmann. She admits this to a portrait of her mother on the wall. Now Miracle conjures up the mother's ghost. The mother encourages her daughter to sing. She launches a grand-scale melody that begins, "Dearest child, I'm calling you as I did before." Now we have the climactic trio, with Antonia transfixed by what she describes as this fire dazzling my eyes. She longs for a single moment of ecstasy before her soul ascends to heaven. This is by some distance the most dramatic music Offenbach ever composed. How incredible that the composer of such light pieces as La Pericole and La Grande Duchesse de Gerolstein was capable of this music. As Antonia finally collapses, Crespel rushes in. His daughter has time to sing just a few lines of the love song she'd sung with Hoffmann. She's the only character that I can think of who expires on a sustained trill. When Hoffmann appears with Niklaus, the raging Crespel attempts to stab him. Miracle pronounces Antonia dead as Crespel and Hoffmann cry out in despair. We move for the next act to a palazzo on the Grand Canal of Venice. Steps lead down to the water, and we can see gondolas floating by. One of them contains the courtesan Giulietta with Niklaus. The two of them sing a barcarolle. Listening to it, you can almost see the water lapping against the sides of the gondola. This melody is beloved everywhere, but what are they actually singing about? Well, it could hardly be more romantic. Beautiful night, O night of love, smile on our rapture. Warming gentle breezes, pour on us your caresses. Giulietta questions Niklaus about Hoffmann's behavior. He likes to drink? Now and then. For consolation? Yes, he's lost the girl he was going to marry. So apparently not much time has passed between Hoffmann's being in Munich and his arrival in Venice. There are beautiful girls at the palazzo, Giulietta's cohorts. But Niklaus says Hoffmann has no interest in them. Instead, he's become jaded. What he seems to want is drinking and gambling. When we first see him in this act, he's launching into a drinking song. To hell with the man who weeps for two beautiful eyes. This number really needs to be thrown off by the tenor, with immense bite in the voice, great rhythmic drive, and terrific panache.
Amen.
Julieta introduces Hoffmann to her rejected lover, Schlemihl, clearly the jealous type. As the guests move to the gaming room, Hoffmann tells Niklaus he's planning to win at the tables, even if the devil himself is his opponent. Just as he says that, a gondola arrives, and out of it steps the mysterious magician Dappertutto. He surprises Hoffmann in addressing him by name, and he adds, "I know all Julieta's visitors. I'm her oldest friend. She's waiting for you." Once Dappertutto is alone, he pulls out the weapon with which he intends to lure Julieta. It's a huge diamond. He urges it to shine and attract Julieta, like the mirror that captures the lark. The aria is a perfect example of the kind of change this opera has been subjected to throughout its performance history. We can never forget that the composer never saw the piece on stage. We'll never totally know what his final thoughts about it might have been. Over time, scholars have made hugely valuable contributions to the life of this opera, but back in 1904 in Monte Carlo, the changes came from the producer. The diamond aria is there because Raoul Gainsbourg wanted it. André Bloch and Pierre Barbier took music from an Offenbach operetta of 1875, Le Voyage dans la Lune, The Trip to the Moon, and out of that they created Saint-Yves Diamant, as a vehicle for a great singer, the baritone Maurice Renaud. This aria is a supreme test of legato, and if the singer does it in the printed key, he needs a sustained high G-sharp at the end. Singers often transpose the aria down, but Ernest Blanc, in this recording, sings it in the proper key. That Dappertutto, with Julieta's help, had previously stolen Schlemihl's shadow. Now he wants to steal Hoffmann's reflection. Just as Dappertutto leaves, Hoffmann appears, making clear that he's leaving, having just lost everything at the gambling tables. Julieta begs him to stay. Her allure starts to work its magic, and Hoffmann responds to her with a declaration of love. Oh, Dieu, de quelle ivresse embrases-tu mon âme? Oh, God, with what rapture you ignite my soul. This is a brief aria, but it's one of the greatest vocal challenges for a tenor in French opera. It just keeps moving higher and higher, and the tenor has to retain the beauty and shine of his voice under incredible pressure. Because Nicolas Yeda sings it so magnificently, I want you to hear the whole aria. What Giulietta now wants is for Hoffmann to give her something of himself as proof of his love, his reflection. He consents, and they sing together, "Today it's tears for us, but tomorrow it's heaven." Giulietta's desperate, and her feelings affect Hoffmann to the point that the music turns almost hysterical. Suddenly, Hoffmann becomes distraught. He laments that love has overpowered him, as Giulietta confesses that she's enslaved to her desire for the diamond. Niklaus laments that the poet's heart will break. Dapertutto and Giulietta's servant Pitichinaccio ridicule Hoffmann, and Schlemihl confesses his longing to kill him. This is a sextet, but the chorus's involvement makes it more commonly referred to as a septet. It, too, was a creation requested from Bloch and Barbier for Monte Carlo to make a more exciting climax for the Giulietta act. This performance comes from the recording led by Sylvain Cambrelin, with Neil Schickoff, Jesse Norman, Anne Murray, José Van Damme, Robert Teer, and Dale Dusing.
Thank you.
Flamel argues with Hoffmann over a key that will admit the owner into Giulietta's boudoir. Dapertutto gives Hoffmann his sword, and Hoffmann duels with Flamel, killing him. Hoffmann rushes to the boudoir, finds it empty, and then sees a gondola floating away. In it are the laughing Giulietta and Pitichinaccio, with Dapertutto at the helm. Niklaus drags Hoffmann away. A comment by critic John Ardoin can help us better understand this opera. He called it a symbolic work in which the women Hoffmann pursues are the varying sides of love itself, from the mindless to the ideal to the carnal. Just as the opera's villains form four aspects of evil out to thwart Hoffmann's genius. Put in simplest terms, the opera is basically a triangle involving Hoffmann, Stella, and Lindorf, with the latter two appearing in different guises. In the epilogue, we're back at Luther's tavern. Having told the three stories, Hoffmann now intends to drink himself into a stupor. The young men all join in the drinking chorus we heard in the prologue. Hoffmann is lost in his drink-induced thoughts. He's now addressed by Niklaus, but not really. It's Niklaus's alter ego, the muse of poetry. What a wonderful effect is made here by Offenbach's using the speaking voice. "What about me?" asked the muse. "Do I mean nothing to you? Through me, you can escape your sadness. The man is no more. Be born again, poet. I love you."
Et moi, moi la fidèle amie, dont la main essuya tes yeux, par qui la douleur endormie s'exhale en rêve dans les cieux, ne suis-je rien que la tempête des passions s'apaise en toi? L'homme n'est plus. Renais, poète, je t'aime, Hoffmann, appartiens-moi.
Hoffmann revives himself to sing the same love music he'd sung to Giulietta, virtually the entire formidably difficult aria, Au Dieu de quelle ivresse. But now he feels totally consumed by a glowing flame, and he concludes, "Beloved muse, I'm yours." He collapses just as Stella enters. Lindorf lurks in the shadows as she asks Niklaus quietly, "Is he asleep?" "No," says Niklaus, "just dead drunk." Stella leaves on Lindorf's arm, and the students again sing their drinking song as the curtain falls. Well, who knows what will happen to Hoffmann? Will he drink himself to an early grave? Maybe there's hope for him. Maybe he really will listen to the muse and devote himself to his poetry. Or maybe another woman will appear who will really make things right for him. Let's be hopeful. The recordings you heard were used courtesy of EMI Classics. Thank you for listening.